You're listening to WCOM FM 103.5, Chapel Hill and Carrboro. Hello and welcome to Focus on Business. I'm your host, Lee Strickland. Here's a reminder that the comments, views, and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of WCOM, its board, and its underwriters. Today's topic is human resources, employment law, business practices, and why you need to be concerned about how you do business. There's a rising cost of doing business and being compliant with human resources aspects. There's explosive growth in lawsuits related to overtime pay, labor law issues, FMLA leave, privacy, use of social media, and repercussions for firing and terminating people for things that are used in social media, for lax employment practices and during the hiring or promotion process or during terminations, on new supervisors taking over, on how we are running our businesses and utilizing and managing and complying with human resource regulations. And so I want to walk through some of the things today on those issues. So are you putting your business at risk related to human resource mistakes? Are you making mistakes during the interviewing process and the type of wording on the job ads, on interviews for promotions, on how you pay your employees and when you pay them? Well, you're at risk. If we walk, if we breathe, if we have employees, we're at risk for lawsuits and litigation and other aspects related to compliance with regulations and how we conduct our business in the HR realm. And so we need to be educated, we need to be informed, we need to be aware of changes as they happen to regulations, our state regulations, and our federal regulations. And so the more informed we are, the more aware we are, the more someone in our organization is staying current, then we're putting on a flak jacket. We're protecting ourselves from that bullet of a lawsuit. Doesn't mean we won't get shot at, but it does mean that we have some protection by falling back on having qualified advice, properly documented processes and procedures, and being aware of what we're required to do and when. And so where does that start? It starts from the first time we have to start recruiting an employee to join our organization. It begins with the job description of what that employee is going to be doing for our organization and what are the bona fide requirements and qualifications for that position. You need to define the essential job functions for that position, including any physical requirements for lifting heavy objects, for repetitive processes, things required for visual acuity or hearing acuity. You need to be able to define the secondary duties and responsibilities, attendance requirements, work hours, dress codes, education requirements, specific skills necessary to perform that job, what standards they're going to be held to, how that performance is going to be measured, whether that's quantitatively or qualitatively. Things like a salesperson should bring in 10 new prospects a month. They should make, you know, 20 sales calls to existing customers or past customers. They need to close 5 new sales in the month. Things like that, we need to be specific. We need to be understanding and clear on who will be supervising that position and how they will be supervising it, when performance reviews will be given and how those performance reviews will be conducted and by whom. And if a position is for a new hire in a new supervisory position, and it's the first time they've been a supervisor or a manager, then we need to explain the expectations of who they will be supervising and their expectations of performance and on communication and handling of performance reviews and all those types of aspects of being a supervisor and a manager in an organization. We may want to have internal training on our processes and our procedures, someone designated to coach them, mentor them through that process in the organization, whether that's their supervisor or a peer or someone in HR. We may want to send them to standardized external training related to being a first-time manager, first-time supervisor. And we have very expensive alternatives, and we have low-cost alternatives that are out there, and it's just a matter of researching and finding someone that has a good program, a well-respected program that will keep them current. I know in my business, I still stay current on HR. I stay current on sales law, sales and use tax law changes. And I do that by taking continuing education courses in those elements. I also stay current on technology. And so in our organizations, we need, as leaders, as business owners, to keep an awareness, to keep current, because we can delegate authority. We delegate accountability to some aspects, but we cannot delegate the liability to our organization. We hire someone in, we put them in this job description, we train them, we coach them, we have them doing their job, we measure their performance periodically. Maybe over time we need to have a new position come open, we post it internally, we also post it externally, we're doing those interviews. We have to ask ourselves, is our team trained on how to do interviews? Do they understand what questions they can and cannot ask? Do they understand the job description they're hiring for, the metrics we're going to be measuring, those bona fide qualifications that have been built in there, and the type of questions that they can ask in those contexts, in that context? And so we need to be aware of training our employees to be effective interviewers, to pick up on the right messages, to ask the right questions, to be able to look at a resume, and to know when it's appropriate to make notes and what kind of notes they're going to make, and understand that their conduct in that interview is expected to be at a professional standard, a qualified standard, and a knowledgeable standard as to what is being expected of them. So we promote people. Again, we need to think about training them and making sure they're informed on what it means in their new role, what their expectations are, who they're going to be supervised, who they're reporting to, and all of those types of processes. We also need to be educating them on exempt and non-exempt employees. Our entire organization needs to understand, as an employee, I'm in this position, that means I'm an exempt employee, and I'm not eligible for overtime. I'm in this position and I am a non-exempt employee. I am eligible for overtime, and this is how this works. And so in managing our resources and managing our people and the amount of money we're paying in our budgets, it's critical for our supervisors and managers to understand wage and hour laws, overtime when it comes to straight time, overtime, and when compensation is going to occur, when we're asking our employees to travel, to fly to a different location, to be on call 24 hours a day for a period of time. If they're going to take a day trip, they're going to take a week-long trip, we might have to have them fly out on a Sunday and back on a Saturday, and they work a 40 or 50-hour week with the customer. When will they still get time deducted for having, you know, their breaks, their lunch hour? Are they working through their lunch hours? We just need to be aware of the normal activities and what we're asking them to do, and make it clear to our organization when time is paid for and when time is not paid for, when time falls into overtime rules and becomes time and a half, and when it's not. If we're going to try to use comp time as small businesses, as private sector businesses, as for-profit businesses, there is a limited use of comp time within a work period, within that period, you can offset to keep someone from going over 40 hours and into overtime. But once they've worked overtime, that overtime is payable. We need to be aware of the laws. If we don't have someone in our organization that has the HR function, that is trained, that is aware, that is an HR specialist, then we need to look outside our organization to an HR consultant, to employment law specialists, to benefit specialists to help us develop our policies and procedures to keep us current, to keep us informed, to keep our employee manuals current, to have conversations to guide us through recruiting, job descriptions, hiring, any changes in work schedules, those types of things to make sure that we are still compliant. If we send people to mandatory training and it's after hours, we need to understand when it's required for us to pay them for that mandatory training. And if it's mandatory, it's outside their normal workday, you're generally going to have to pay for that. If it's a voluntary training program, it's optional. You may not have to pay for it, but it kind of depends on your business and what's considered voluntary and whether an employee really thinks it is voluntary and whether, let's be honest, it truly is voluntary. And we need to think about that. When we send employees for training, when we have them on call 24/7, when they go on vacation and we reach out to them because some kind of issue is and they're gonna log in from wherever they are or they're on their smartphone doing something for us or they make a customer call, can we dock them for that vacation time or do we give them back hours? Do we have to give them back the hours they worked or would you have to give them back the whole day? One of the guys I worked with at a company, one of my last corporate jobs, was in IT. And he had worked for the company, I want to say, at that point, 15 years. He was up to having, you know, he'd had 2 weeks vacation a year, then 3 weeks, and I think he was up to 4 or 5 weeks of vacation. But in the entire 16 years he had worked for that company, not one vacation day had been recorded as used because he was always getting called when he was on vacation to log in to do something, and that's something maybe 2 hours or 4 hours, and sometimes it was the entire day out of his vacation. And so he didn't get charged for those days, which is right and based on policy. And the company also had another policy that you could not roll over vacation days. And so it was use it or lose it. But in his case, because the company was the cause of him not being able to use the days, there had to be an exception to that rule. And all of his vacation days had been rolling over for like 16 years. And he said at some point he was going to stop, and he was still fairly young. He'd started, I think he was 20 when he started with the company, so he was about 35. He said when he reached 2 years of accumulated vacation time, he was going to be leaving the company. They were going to be writing him a very big check for that time because that was part of the agreement, too, that if he left, that time would go, and he would be able to have 2 years of salary to come with him to cover his costs as he was starting his business in that first 2 years. And so he wasn't complaining about that them always calling him and him being that valuable of a resource because there was a payoff. He was valued. He felt it. He was getting to keep his benefits. He was getting to roll it over, and he had a plan for it. But from a company standpoint, that's all well and good. But if we are so dependent on one employee that we can't let them take a vacation day, then we need to look at how we're running the business and that expectation. And so especially in the financial aspect of our business, it's always a good practice to make sure everyone in finance or accounting, in procurement, in aspects that are dealing with purchases and use of funds, that someone has to be on vacation and someone else is doing that job while they're on vacation, because it puts another set of eyes in there and it's a check and balance to make sure nothing funny is going on in that role. And so we need to understand when our business practices, when our processes and procedures and how we run and our business functions triggers exceptions to our normal policies and document those, when our requirement to be on call on weekends will trigger a need to compensate somebody that's a non-exempt employee. If someone is working a position and they're designated, let's say they work at one of our facilities and it's 10 miles from their house and they drive there and that is their designated job facility. Let's say they have to drive another facility and it's 50 miles away. Well, if the employee starts asking for the mileage and the time paid from the difference between them driving 5 minutes to get into work and them driving possibly an hour with traffic to get to that other facility, is that travel time, is that mileage reimbursable because it's a change from their normal designated location of employment? That's a question that has to be asked of your employment law attorney, of your HR specialist, and it may be dependent on their role in the business. It may also be dependent on the state laws and the federal laws, and it's important to ask those questions as to when you have to pay the extra mileage for the difference in having them go to a different location when it's not their normal work location, and is that time compensated? I remember working for one employer that required all employees to go to their designated work location and leave from there, even if they're going to use their personal car. And so they would drive into their work location, whether that was a 5 minute, 10 mile commute or, you know, a 50 minute, 50 mile commute. They would have to go there and then they would have to drive to the other facility. And at the time when I was working there, I lived in the almost equal distance from all three facilities I supported. So from my perspective, it took me just about as long to get to each one. But when they made the policy, you had to go to your designated place of work, that facility, and then drive to the other facilities. Well, I was driving an hour to the facility I was assigned to, and then I would have to drive another hour to the next facility and 2 hours to the facility that was furthest away from it. And so some days I would be getting paid for 4 hours of commuting between facilities because of that policy, and only get to work 4 hours or 5 hours out of the day, rather than if I had driven straight to the facility, treated it as a normal commute for me, and then worked the full day there and drove back. And so we also don't want to unduly burden or constrain our workers from that. So we need to think from our business processes how we translate into that to requirements and what we're going to compensate our employees for, write those policies, check that they're compliant with federal and state labor laws and rules, and if we have discretion, handle those in a discretionary way, but handle them consistently for every employee in our organization. You can't have different rules for executives and different rules for non-executives unless there is a bona fide reason. It's non-discriminatory, et cetera. And again, it's important to invest in having HR expertise in our organization to do things well, to create a flak jacket, a bulletproof vest that helps protect at least most of our business from compliance issues, from litigation. And even if there is a lawsuit, helps mitigate the cost of that lawsuit because we've done things right. We've complied with the rules. We've sought qualified expertise in making the decision to how the business is going to operate. So again, from the time we hire an employee or start recruiting employees to hiring them, to interviewing them for promotions, to putting them in new positions and training them, to dealing with whether they're exempt and or non-exempt, which should be defined in the job description and may change. We started going through this at the end of last year where exempt and non-exempt status was going to change based on federal law as to what the minimum salary was going to be. A lot of businesses changed their entire organizational structures to eliminate some positions that had been exempt before and now were becoming non-exempt, shifted workloads, did all kinds of things in the face of that new policy that was supposed to be implemented on December 1st of 2016. And then it didn't get implemented. It got delayed and it's never going to be implemented likely, or at least not in the foreseeable future. And so we just need to be aware of employees that we're putting in positions that are non-exempt employees and are going to be eligible for overtime. We're going to make sure that that overtime they work is properly compensated at time and a half, double time, triple time, depending on whether it's contractual rules or just normal rules of federal and state laws that say time and a half. When does overtime kick in? Does overtime kick in on at a day rate? So after you work 8 hours, you automatically start getting to time and a half effort, or is it based on a work week when you get over 40 hours in the week? If you're working for a government entity or a nonprofit, does it make a difference? Does it make it if you're working for a local municipality or a state agency or the federal government as to when overtime is eligible? We just really need to be aware of it. In one of my corporate jobs, I was in a non-exempt position, but our normal work week was 70 hours a week, and that was 6 days a week. Our starting time and our ending time were on our time cards, but not a punch out for lunch. So they always deducted an hour a day from whatever those hours were. So if I came in at 6 o'clock in the morning and left at 7 o'clock at night, that 13-hour day would become a 12-hour day. The problem with that is that for a 3-month period, I worked through lunch 6 days a week because there were mandatory meetings on the lunch hour, and yet the employer continued to deduct that hour from my time. So when I worked a 13-hour day, I was really working a 13-hour day, but they were paying for a 12-hour day. A lot of times they didn't want to pay time and a half, and they said, well, the manager or supervisor would say, well, I'm going to give you comp time. Well, again, as a private sector for-profit entity, comp time had to occur within a week. You couldn't push it to a pay period. You couldn't say, well, I'm going to offset your overtime for this week when you work 30 hours overtime, and then I'm going to let you take 30 hours off next week. Or because next week, you never got 30 hours off the next week. And accumulated and accumulated and accumulated. At one point, I had 6 weeks of accumulated, quote-unquote, comp time at straight time. And so we needed to understand, and the organization needed to understand, if I had so chosen, I was getting paid for it because I was one of those people that knew the HR rules because I was trained in HR, that I was entitled to that time and a half. And comp time didn't come into play for that. And if I had wanted to push it, I could have filed suit, and it would have been a class action suit because there were entire departments and parts of the organization that were forcing employees into comp time. And so, again, an irate employee, a disgruntled employee can open the doors to litigation that's not just related to their specific issue, but opens a larger door for the U.S. Department of Labor, for attorneys, to make class action suits for investigations that leads to fine, penalties, and settlements. And one of the cases I want to share with you today gets back to that, and it gets back to when an employer made a decision to alter a time card. The supervisor made a decision to change the pay records for a person. Now, the supervisor, by making that, incurs personal liability. The HR manager could be liable, the managers can be liable, and the business is ultimately liable for the compensation not being correct. And so the supervisor was altering time cards to get off the clock work. So people were actually working, but they weren't getting paid for the work. A bit like when the company I worked for was automatically deducting an hour for a lunch hour that no one got to take. And so last year, the Department of Labor, U.S. Department of Labor, started looking at that and looking at the fact that the employer, the supervisor, was working people through their mandatory breaks, through their mandatory time period, their mandatory lunches. And so people were not getting compensated for the work they were doing. And so when you looked at that, the court held that the CEO was responsible and that the back pay and a penalty was incurred. So that was almost $750,000 that employer had to pay out for that issue. Another case where an employer made a mistake in how they handled things created about a $586,000 settlement, and I'm looking at my notes here. I'm losing track. In my show notes here. So something that was just very simple, the employer could have handled. The employer could have handled because again, it's a technology advance. The employer made a decision, and we've seen stories in the past week or so about an employer in Wisconsin that was putting biometric chips, scanners, in the right hand of each of their employees. Well, this is not, that's not the first company to do it. So a couple of years ago, last year, another company had done it. The employee objected to having a biochip in. That was a Christian employee that believed that having such a device, having such an instrument in their right hand would be constitute a mark of the beast, and which is addressed in the book of Revelations for end time prophecy, and asked for an alternative way to log in, to have a security badge, essentially, to continue to have the security badge to continue to log in to the organization and to access systems. The employer refused. Well, the Christian employee sued. The court agreed that there should have been an accommodation. It was a bona fide religious request, and an exemption that the employer should have made an alternative system for anyone that objected to that. It wasn't an undue burden for them to do that. They could have used a timesheet. They could have had a security card to get into the facilities, because it was not an undue hardship to require an alternative for the employee. The judge awarded $586,000 to the employee who sued the company. And so, again, we need to be aware of when we have to accommodate religious beliefs, disabilities, FMLA leave requests, and those kind of things. But we don't have to comply with things to the point that it is an undue hardship, or that when employees are abusing benefits or exemptions like intermittent FMLA leave. So sometimes employees get into a habit or a preference. They want to work the system. Not all of them. Most employees are great, and they value the ability to use FMLA for themselves, for their children, for other relatives when they're caring for them. But when it comes down to dealing with intermittent FMLA leave, we have harder times as organizations to understand when it's an appropriate use of intermittent leave and when it's an abuse of intermittent leave. And so employers need to have policies and procedures that cover a way to request intermittent leave if it's offered in their organization and under the laws, and how to make an intermittent leave request, how to schedule that, how the business is going to accommodate that. And 9 times out of 10, I'm going to say, and again, I'm not an attorney, that when an employee suddenly takes FMLA leave, it's unscheduled, it's unexpected, and wants to use intermittent FMLA leave, it's not intended to cover those unintended breaks, those last minute appointments, things that can damage the productivity of the business. And so courts have been coming out related to employees filing suit because they weren't allowed to use intermittent FMLA leave and arriving late to work. Again, an unscheduled use of intermittent leave, because of needing extended restroom breaks. That wasn't an intermittent, a use of intermittent FMLA leave that was acceptable. There's just different things out there. And again, with a qualified HR person, someone that understands how FMLA is supposed to be applied, whether that's an HR consultant, whether that's an employment law specialist, attorney, they can help guide you on setting your policy and having someone to be your phone a friend to say, I have an employee wanting to use intermittent FMLA leave. They don't schedule it. They aren't following the policy. Is it intermittent leave? Do I have to allow it? Those types of things. If we don't know it, we need to have someone on hand on call to answer those questions. If we don't have an HR specialist, a well-trained, experienced HR person in the organization, then we need to make the investment in having consultants, having an attorney that specializes in these types of aspects of the business to help us write our policy and procedure manuals, to help us put together a compliant employee manual, to spell out our FMLA leave, how we're going to accommodate our promotional processes, how we're going to post jobs, to look at our job descriptions to see if they're written properly, if we are handing out interview questions that we want each of our our interviewers to ask candidates to make sure those questions are allowable questions. And we just need to be cognizant of how important it is to stay current on the laws and to stay current on other things that impact policies and procedures or the need for policies and procedures in our organization. Social media, use of personal devices or use of devices that are business devices, our tablets, smartphones, and computers for personal use of accessing their Facebook, their media, streaming music, it all those number of things that technology is rapidly changing, and we're usually running behind in crafting and forming how we're going to handle that. IT security and logging in and maintaining control of devices and passwords, maintaining electronic privacy for customer records, for our employee records, for our vendor records. It's a risk that's there for our organization, and we have to communicate our expectations of how our employees are going to adhere to those policies and procedures that we establish with regard to those. And we need that guidance from our attorneys on where can we put the boundaries for them using social media, whether it's the company's accounts or their own personal accounts. What is actionable that takes place outside of the workforce in social media or on devices that are owned by the business? Are we monitoring those devices? Do we have that right? It's those types of things. Whose records are they? And we need to define those, or we can quickly get into a trap of getting caught behind the eight ball and dealing with things that are occurring that we didn't expect because of technology changes or how technology is used that makes our business vulnerable for breaches of security, for breaches like Sony's had them. I think it's Disney. They're being held up, blackmailed, extorted because someone was able to hack into their IT security. We've had employee records, medical records released from companies, databases, all those different types of things. And a lot of it is awareness and building awareness in our employees as to when and where it's appropriate to use it, especially the devices, how to maintain proper control of passwords and login IDs, when to change them, all of those kind of things are things we want to build into our processes. Our people are our most valuable resources. We need to treat them that way. We need to compensate them that way. We need to respect them and obey the rules of compliance. And we need to be compassionate, but hold people accountable. We need to be consistent. As one of my one of the supervisors that was training me when I was in the UAW environment, he said you needed to be friendly, you needed to be fair, and you needed to be frank. And as long as you were consistent, you were friendly, fair, and frank, you could communicate with the employees, you could get respect, and the rules had to apply to everyone equally. And so we need to think about our business and how it's operating and how to communicate that so that we can capture the processes, we can capture the risk points, and we can make our business as effective, as efficient, as compassionate and respectful as it can be and still stay profitable in our businesses. We also need to know when we are putting employees into activities that are not normal job roles, but make them agents of our business. So a lot of organizations for decades have had volunteer hours in their organizations that kind of give back. So what happens when you're compensating an employee for those volunteer hours inside of the in another organization and that employee does something wrong? Couple of the worst cases I've heard from past employers was an employee who was driving drunk on a company car, doing a company activity, and was speeding, driving drunk, and killed three people. The company was deemed liable by the court because the person was an agent at the time, driving a company vehicle for a company purpose, between two company facilities, and it was foreseeable that he was drunk when he got behind the wheel because people did know he was drunk when he left the one facility, and so they were liable. In another instance, a volunteer, employees were asked to volunteer and participate with a children's group. One of the employees that did the volunteering was on payroll, was being paid for those volunteer times, was a pedophile. And the unthinkable happened, and the company was liable for his activity because at that time he was being compensated as an employee to be there to volunteer with that organization. And so, again, they were liable and should have taken extra care in screening who was participating in those types of programs was actually part of the ruling. So we need to understand the activities that we ask our employees to engage in their normal course of their jobs, where they're commuting to, if they're traveling for training, to customer sites, to vendor sites, where are the risks that we can be exposing them to if we're mandating that they volunteer so many hours with different organizations. We need to be able to determine if it's appropriate for a particular employee to be engaged in that particular activity or with that particular group. And so we just need an awareness. We don't discriminate in employing people because of felonies or other convictions or however, we are also responsible for making sure that we do not put pedophiles as volunteers in children's organizations or at schools. We're responsible for not sending an employee who is an alcoholic and has a drinking problem to an event where he's going to be serving beer or alcohol. It's those types of things that we just have to be compassionate and aware and make sure that we're following the rules, we're compliant in the rules, we're non-discriminatory, but we are protecting those people that we're engaging with the employees and our business by not exposing ourselves to risks. So when off-site employees are off-site, but they are engaged in an activity that is approved by the organization, they're using facilities, they're going between locations, they're using their personal car, going somewhere else. Let's say even, you know, sending an employee out to get coffee can put the business at risk if he's in an accident and something happens. There have been court cases over it. So the lesson is that when an employee is off site, they get injured, they're being compensated, it's not excluded from part of their workday. If they're there because you've asked them to be there, you've asked them to be there because they're an employee, you're paying them for their time, then understand that whether they're on the work site and in an accident or they're off site in an accident, as long as they're an agent and working for you at that point in time, and generally that's going to fall under your workers' comp things. And so we need to be aware but not paranoid about the decisions we make and when we ask people to engage outside of the business or off-site of our businesses as to, are they going to get compensated? Are they acting as an agent at that point? Is it mandatory activity? Is it voluntary? Are they being paid? Those types of things to make decision factors as to when we're going to do things. So we need to be aware of those regulations as to when things kick in related to workers' comp, when should we have insurance, what's covered, when, you know, what's the scope of the activities. We need to understand and comply with changes in the FMLA leave, the Family and Medical Leave Act, FMLA, Americans with Disabilities Act, the ADA. We're still complying with Obamacare elements and reporting. We're looking at, you know, changes in minimum wage rates increasing around different states. We have just different things that go into effect, things that were executive orders under Obama that have now been reversed by another executive order by President Trump. We need to be aware of those changes and how they ripple through our organization. We just need to keep ourselves informed. We need to keep our employees informed in those. And if it mandates, if changes in regulations, mandated change in your employee manuals, conditions of employment, overtime rules, minimum wage rules, then we need to keep our posters and other communication tools up to date. You can get posters for labor rules type things from the U.S. Department of Labor website at www.dol.gov/elaws/posters.html. Should be able to download and print a lot of those. You don't have to invest huge amounts of money in getting the laminated ones, the big ones that you will frequently get letters saying, you know, it's time to update your posters, and you think you have to purchase those because it looks like an official thing. But it's just a sales thing. You have to understand who gets access to things like the copies of I-9s. There's some changes in the laws on I-9s. And so we need to be aware that we should be using a new I-9 form. Again, you can get that at the IRS website, and just type in I-9 and search for it and download it and update those. I like to advise clients, again, to maintain those in a separate binder. Just make sure it's noted that you do have it from each employee. You've verified the right identification, and then maintain those in a separate binder on the shelf, so that if they do get audited, you don't have to give access to someone to the employee files. You just need to produce a list of the employees and have them look at the I-9s in that binder. And that's another thing in small businesses. One of my past employers, when I came in as the chief finance person, I was also over IT, and I was looking at the files and realized that all the employee files were open to anybody in the company to see them. So people had access to birth dates of the employee, their family members, social security numbers, compensation, medical records, everything was there. And I locked it down. And people started complaining, and I was like, why were you in that file anyway? It's not work-related. Well, it's always been open. It's like, well, it's none of your business. That's confidential. It should never have been opened. The CEO didn't even have rights to see aspects of that. The board of directors didn't. There has to be a bona fide reason for someone to see the personnel file. The employee can see the personnel file, but that's also somewhat discretionary. So that's up to federal law, says there's no guarantee of rights to see your own personnel file, but some states do give employees the right to inspect the personnel file. And so you need to be aware of that and know what's going on in the states you operate in. It could be different in every state. And if you write a policy, again, we want to be consistent in our policies around the organization, and you may have different policy manuals for operations in, say, New Jersey versus Indiana versus Texas versus California. And so we just need to be non-discriminatory, even with the variations in policies and procedures and rules based on law in the different states we operate in. So compassionate communication, fair, frank communication, understanding our roles and responsibilities, understanding the evolution of technology and the impact on confidential information and maintaining confidential information, use of devices that are company provided. What happens if someone gets spammed with porn and it's on there and they report it to IT, or they don't even realize it's happened, or someone clicks on a link, a phishing link, and gets malware? What are the policies and procedures for dealing with that, for reporting it? What if someone is putting porn on the devices because they like porn and it's a company device? Are you allowed to be monitoring those devices? Do you have to disclose the monitoring policy for monitoring devices? And those are questions you need to consult your HR expert in and your employment law attorney, IT law, those types of things to protect yourself. Something else that we don't think about as being part of HR is protecting ourselves against a loss of a key employee. So we have a key employee may be the owner of the business if you're a small business. It may be your chief technologist or your science researchers. We need to protect ourselves from the standpoint of what happens in our business if that person is no longer there through leaving the company voluntarily or involuntarily because some breach of rules, they're fired. If they become ill and have extended sick leave, if they become disabled, or heaven forbid they die. Part of our HR role in the business is to be involved in succession planning, to understanding the roles and responsibilities in the organization, and to raise that with the key leaders of the organization to make sure that they're aware that this particular person is the only person filling this job description, and that's a make or break job description for the business. We need to address issues like confidential information and proprietary information. Employees that are current employees that are making copies of vendor records, of customer records, of the key contacts for the organization. What are they doing with them? Why are they accessing it? I had early on when I started my business, which was in 2002, I had a competitor's current employee call me, he was a VP, and say, I can give you the list of all of their customers and, you know, and stuff. And he was a disgruntled employee, and he was aiming for a job with my organization. He was bringing in information. And my response to him was, that's an illegal offer. That would disqualify you automatically from being part of my company. It's illegal for you to offer me that information, to provide that information, and lose my number, don't contact me. And it boggles the mind how many times employees working in sales or working in some kind of contact in the organization have access to that information, and they take that information with them when it's proprietary information, and it's a breach of policies, it's a breach of procedures, it's a breach of intellectual property law in most instances, because that is proprietary confidential information. Because so in HR, we also need to be mapping out and guiding the organization on defining who has access to proprietary information, making sure everyone acknowledge their understanding of the contacts and the customers, the vendors. That information is the company's information, and signing something that acknowledges that ownership of the company for that, because they are in a work role. If they develop a friendship with the banker, and they end up with their private home information and stuff, that's not controllable. But when they're downloading and exporting and deliberately taking all the contact information of the customers, the vendors, pricing, all those kind of stuff, that's something that we need to have incorporated in our policies and procedures and shared within the organization to define proprietary and confidential information. Work for hire, it becomes the product of the employer. Something else we also have to take in consideration is when we have people inventing and creating products or vaccines or biopharma, whatever type of things on behalf of the company. I had one company approach me as a startup seeking government funding, and I knew the guy had been employed at a larger company, and he said, but my name's on the patent as an inventor, so I can take this. It's my patent. I invented it. And the reality was, no, it was work for hire. He was paid for that. Yes, he was an inventor, but he was not an owner or co-owner of the patent and had no right to use it. And so he was violating, I call the company Goliath, because it was a major international company that had deep pockets and could pursue him for that. And so he could not accept a government grant to do research on furthering that patent basic information, because he had no right to exercise or use the content of the science inside that patent. And so those are the types of things that we need to take the time to detail and explain as part of our orientation process, as a recurring type of awareness building inside the organization as to how their role in the organization is impacted and plays with confidential proprietary intellectual property and information. And so HR is more than being a traffic cop. It's more than payroll. It's more than the hiring and firing process, even though all of those are critical and important. HR is a partner in the success of the business by helping us hire the right people for well-defined roles, make sure they're compensated well, that their performance is monitored and measured, and that we're compliant with all the rules and regulations that the government has put in place at the federal and the state level. We need to be aware of setting pay standards, being non-discriminatory in our pay in our hiring practices. And we need to be aware of how communication within and outside of our organization is perceived, is translated back to our policies and procedures related to discrimination. And we need to also address things. And the story pops into my mind of the gentleman, I believe it was at Google, that wrote something about having fewer women available for coding to hire in the departments. And it's a statistical fact. It really is a statistical fact that for most of the coding positions, there are fewer women applying for them because there are fewer women going into those professions at this point in time, in this country at least. Overseas, it may be different. And so we're seeing you can't represent the female population mix in a particular department for a particular skill set if the women are not there to be hired. If they don't meet the bona fide requirements for education, for special skills that we talked about in putting in a job description. Now, if a company wanted to proactively create a program to recruit women, to pay for them to go to school, to lock them in, to coming to work for them as a condition of paying for school for such a period of time, then you know, they could do something like that to rebalance the workforce. But that would require them to take a special effort to identify women who wanted to go into specific careers, to get qualified, to get them to pass and go through those schools, and then to translate them into those positions, maybe through apprenticeships, through internships, plus formal schooling. That's something a business can do. Is it a terminating offense for a manager in an organization to state a statistical fact that there are fewer women to recruit into those positions just because fewer women go into professions? That's probably going to be a question for the courts. Because when you terminate somebody for stating something and call it discriminatory, you open yourself up to litigation. Because if he can prove it's not a discriminatory thing, it's a fact that can be statistically supported, I'm going to argue a jury is going to side on, or even a judge if it's not a non-jury case, will likely side on the part of the person that was terminated. Again, I'm not an attorney, but I am a reasonable thinking human being that when someone states there are fewer women for me to hire, fewer women are applying, fewer women are meeting the bona fide qualifications of the job description, that's not a termination offense. And so we need to think about how we execute our policies and procedures. We need to be informed. We need not jump to conclusions too fast. If we have something pending, if we think it's an issue, we need to be able to have it investigated in the right format within the organization or using independent counsel, an outside attorney, an HR consultant, a specialist, and ask questions early and often. As our businesses evolve and grow and you add more and more employees, generally more and more regulations apply. Regulations change administration to administration. Some administrations add more, some add less. Minimum wages change state by state. There are differences in overtime rules and labor rules state to state. Again, if you're a large organization or maybe even a small business that just has 25 employees, but you operate and have facilities in 5 different states with those 25 employees, you need to understand state by state what the requirements are. It's not insurmountable. It is an investment in the success of your organization, and it is an investment in the longevity of your organization to have a robust HR process from the time you decide you need to add a position to you place the job ad, to you start screening the resumes, that you get the applications, that you start the interviews, that you conduct the interviews, that you hire someone, you give them orientation, you give them training, you put them through the process, you integrate them in, and you measure their performance and give them feedback. Up till the time that they leave the organization for voluntary reasons, for medical reasons, to go to a different job, valuing that employee, understanding their skill set, putting them in the right roles, giving them the right tools, the right training, and keeping your organization a learning organization will keep you focused on success. I see too many people put someone who is a people person in an HR role with no skills, no training, and no exposure to the requirements, the expertise that is needed to truly have a compliant, robust, successful HR organization that partners with the organization to grow, to be effective, to be efficient, to manage the most valuable resource we have in our business, our people. For me, people are as important as capitalization. People that I respect, people that I work well with, people that challenge me, people that are smarter than me, that are people I want to work with when I'm working in the organizations. Who fits in your organization? Who challenges you? Are you willing to delegate authority and accountability? Are you willing to give feedback? Are you willing to be a leader and a manager in your organization? If you are, make an investment in your human resources, in the department, in the activities, and in the people of your organization. The return on investment will be greater than you ever expected, and time and money well spent. Successful organizations going forward are going to be learning organizations. They're going to be organizations that recruit learners, that recruit leaders, that are adaptable, that are able to change with the environment, with the economy, with the challenge of competition, with advances in technology. And the question is, are you a leadership learning organization? Until next time, this is Lee Strickland, and you've been listening to Focus on Business on WCOM FM 103.5, Chapel Hill and Carrboro. And until next time, everyone, stay focused on the important things.